Welcome to Your Call's One Planet series. I'm Ethan Elkind. Scientists and science have long been targeted by various reactionary forces and special interests. However, in recent years, and especially in the months following Donald Trump's return to office, these attacks have escalated dramatically. The Trump administration has aggressively slashed funding for scientific research that does not align with its ideology, including critical work on climate change, COVID-19, vaccines, and more. The administration's hostility towards science is being reinforced by a coordinated campaign of misinformation, deliberate distortion of facts, and increasing threats against scientists and public health figures across the country. So what explains this growing assault towards science from the administration and its ideological base? How did scientists become the enemy of the people? And what forces are behind the systemic campaign to discredit science and scientists? And what are the real-life impacts of this dangerous trend? Our guest today, the leading climate scientist, Dr. Michael Mann, has been at the forefront of this dynamic, both for his cutting-edge climate research and for more than 20 years as a target for climate change deniers and the fossil fuel industry, all because of his relentless work exposing the anti-science industrial complex. Now, in his new book, Science Under Siege, How to Fight the Five Most Powerful Forces That Threaten Our World, which he co-wrote with the distinguished immunologist, pediatrician, and global health advocate, Professor Peter Hotez, Dr. Mann describes the coordinated effort to discredit climate and public health research and how to fight back. Michael Mann is Presidential Distinguished Professor in the Department of Earth and Environmental Science at the University of Pennsylvania, with a secondary appointment in the Annenberg School for Communication. He's also the author of several important books, including The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back Our Planet, and Our Fragile Moment, How Lessons from Earth's Past Can Help Us Survive the Climate Crisis. And of course, as I mentioned, he's the co-author of the brand new book, Science Under Siege, How to Fight the Five Most Powerful Forces That Threaten Our World. Professor Mann, welcome back to Your Call.
Oh, thanks so much. It's great to be with you.
Well, thank you for this really important book. And it's not an exaggeration to see that we live in really unprecedented times with a seismic shift in many aspects of our public life in the U.S. Institutions are going through a serious stress test, a sort of a purge at the governmental level, scientists losing funding. And before we dive into your book, which, as I mentioned, you co-wrote with Professor Peter Hotez, I just wanted to ask you, how do you think we got to this moment here?
Well, thanks. It's great to be with you. It's been a very long road that has led us here, unfortunately. More than a half century that certain special interests started out sort of early on with the tobacco industry when it became clear that the findings of science and scientists were adverse to their business model. The fact that tobacco products, cigarettes cause lung cancer, that science was inconvenient to them. And rather than come forward admit that to the public and take appropriate actions, they simply doubled down in denying that. They attacked the scientists whose findings their own scientists had secretly reaffirmed. The tobacco industry hid their own documents. Their own scientists had determined that, in fact, the independent medical experts were right about this and their product was killing people. There's a memo that actually in one of the documents, the tobacco documents that was leaked, that eventually was made public through litigation, it contains the line, "Doubt is our product." Well, that sort of model, doubt as a product, is something, it's a playbook that the fossil fuel industry took and run with. And now we're seeing it sort of, unfortunately, a medical analogy here, we've seen it metastasize to really infect all of our scientific discourse and arguably our entire body politic.
Well, and the stakes seem to be just even getting higher as we think about the assassination last week of far-right polemicist Charlie Kirk, and you write in your book about how you've been attacked online through email, social media, and sometimes physically menaced, with scientists requiring the protection of law enforcement at times. Yeah. Where do you think this is going next here? I mean, what else do you think these forces might be willing to do?
Yeah, well, and we, you know, in the book, we sort of go through these forces. Who are they? Well, they're plutocrats who fund all of this. The Koch brothers, privately held fossil fuel interest that has funded a lot of the climate denialism and the assault on clean energy, all of these myths we hear about wind energy killing whales, all that stuff, all that misinformation and disinformation. It's funded by plutocrats. So a lot of it is promoted by petrostates, state actors like Russia and Saudi Arabia, who have a vested interest in keeping us addicted to fossil fuels. And, you know, as I said before, it's sort of metastasized well beyond climate to the point where it's almost become ideological that one of the two parties, conservatives and libertarians, the Koch brothers, again, this fossil fuel, privately held fossil fuel interest that had funded climate denial for so long, actually funded a lot of the early assault on public health messaging on COVID-19 because they didn't want lockdowns. They didn't want people to use less fossil fuels. And so they assaulted the science there as well. And they sort of created this rabble now that has been weaponized, that denies the efficacy of vaccines. They've sort of created a monster that they can't even control at this point. And that's why we are where we are at. And there are other actors, other forces that we talk about, but the petrostates and the plutocrats are really the ones who have funded this apparatus.
And Dr. Mann, I want to go through all these different forces that you talk about in the book, but I wanted to ask you just how did you and Peter end up working together on this book? What brought you together to work on it?
Yeah, thanks for that question. So, you know, it was sort of like PTSD for me, to be perfectly honest, when Peter and Tony Fauci and other vaccinologists and public health experts came under fire about 5 years ago now during the COVID-19 pandemic, because again, because of this weaponization by bad actors of anti-science and this rabble that they created that would lash out and you know publicly you know issue literally death warnings against people like Peter. It was PTSD to me because it's exactly what I had gone through more than 2.5 decades ago when we first published the so-called hockey stick curve, this curve that demonstrated the profound warming of the past century, how it coincides with the Industrial Revolution and sort of really communicated in a very graphic way the reality and threat of climate change. And it came under attack by those plutocrats and by those petrostates that I've talked about. And I was assaulted, or death threats against me, threats against my family, demands for me to be fired from my job, et cetera, hauled into Congress to you know sit in the hot seat as fossil fuel funded congressmen and senators try to discredit me and my work, and the list goes on. And then here it is, you know, literally more than 2 decades later, and I see public health scientists like Peter being subject to exactly the same tactics, using a lot of the same methods, a lot of the same basic actors, like I said, plutocrats like the Koch brothers, bad actors like Russia, state actors like Russia. And so I forget if I reached out to Peter or Peter reached out to me, but we realized that, you know, there was something to be gained from talking with each other, having a conversation. It evolved into a friendship. And we realized that there really was a book to be written about the commonality of the attacks that we've received, you know, in these two different domains, and what sort of broader lessons we can learn from them, and how we can fight back in the end.
And you mentioned that graph, the hockey stick graph. Why did that make you a target, and who were the entities that were coordinated in these attacks against you at that time?
Yeah, so this was back in the late 1990s when the fossil fuel industry was still heavily promoting and funding climate denialism. They were denying that climate change was happening. They were attacking the science and the scientists. I wasn't the first climate scientist to be assaulted in this way. A good friend of mine, Ben Santer, formerly at the Lawrence Livermore Laboratory, whose early work played a critical role in the detection of human influence in climate. Years before I came under attack, Ben was attacked in similar ways, vilified on the pages of the Wall Street Journal, demands that he be fired. You know, a lot of this is tied to the fossil fuel industry or the various front groups that they fund. We sometimes call it these AstroTurf organizations. We're supposed to believe that they're grassroots uprisings of citizens, but actually they're funded by the fossil fuel industry or the Koch brothers. Or tied to, like I said, petrostates like Russia and Saudi Arabia. And these groups exist to attack science, attack scientists, And so, you know, I was being attacked sort of from all directions by these various interlinked institutions that are part of this larger science denial apparatus. And what's so remarkable, what Peter and I found so remarkable, is that it wasn't just the tactics, it was the same players. And I think there is a broader assault here that we have to understand. You know, our book, you know, really looks closely at pandemics and the climate crisis, arguably the two greatest existential threats that we face right now. But there's a third threat that maybe is even worse, and that's the weaponization of misinformation and disinformation, and the way that AI is being used to massively spread not just an assault on science, but an assault on reason, on fact-based discourse. That's what we face today. And so the assault on science, it's a fundamental threat to our future, the future of human civilization, and it's part of an even larger assault that we have to get our hands on this, around this. We have to really do something about the way that misinformation and disinformation, intentional misinformation, is being spread massively on social media by bot armies and trolls, often tied to these bad actors, whether they be petrostate actors or fossil fuel interests or groups that are funded by libertarians, to just create doubt and confusion and distrust of experts, because that favors their agenda. If people refuse to trust actual experts, it leaves the field wide open for bad actors to take advantage of the confusion, the division, and move forward with their business as usual agenda.
Well, we're speaking with Michael Mann, Presidential Distinguished Professor in the Department of Earth and Environmental Science at the University of Pennsylvania. We're talking about his new book he has co-authored called Science Under Siege, How to Fight the Five Most Powerful Forces That Threaten Our World. And Dr. Mann is speaking from personal experience as a leading climate scientist who has been under attack by fossil fuel interests, anti-science forces. Well, Dr. Mann, as you talk about the kind of persecution that you were facing, a coordinated campaign against you as you were introducing just the science to the public about what was happening with climate change, you know, decades ago now. Well, how did the scientific community respond to the harassment that you were receiving at that time?
Yeah, well, I received quite a bit of support. At one point, Congressman Joe Barton, who was the Republican chair of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, I believe he was either the top or one of the top few recipients of fossil fuel money in U.S. Congress. And he engaged in an effort to basically to subpoena all of my, papers, documents, force me to defend my science literally within the halls of Congress, putting me in the hot seat and attacking me and bringing in some of his own sort of hired guns to attack me as well. That was back in 2005. So that's, two decades ago. And it was a somewhat different political climate back then. I would point out that some of the biggest heroes in this story who came to defend me, obviously the scientific community, organizations like the American Association for the Advancement of Sciences, the American Meteorological Society, the American Physical Society, all of these groups came out to defend me because they realized this was an ideologically motivated assault on science. And there's a history, as you know, that goes back into the Cold War. In the Manhattan Project, if anybody who's seen the movie Oppenheimer knows how sort of political actors try to undermine public faith in scientists whose work and findings they didn't like. So there's a dark history here. There's a dark history actually in Russia back in the Stalin era. Episode of Trofim Lysenko is called Lysenkoism, when Russia decided that there was a particular scientific orthodoxy that had to do with agriculture, and they purged the scientific community of anybody who didn't agree with this sort of crackpot, and there were famines that resulted from this widespread famine. So there's a dark history here when it comes to the attacks on science, and the scientific community knows about that. And they came to our defense because they understood the stakes here. But what was sort of surprising were that some of the primary political heroes in this particular story were actually Republicans. They were, John McCain, Senator John McCain, who, criticized Joe Barton, his fellow Republican, Joe Barton, in some of the harshest terms, stopping just short of calling him out for engaging in modern day McCarthyism. And Sherwood Bollert, who would come on to become a dear friend. Sadly, he passed away a few years ago. He was the Republican chair of the House Science Committee at the time. And he was sort of an old school pro-science, pro-environment Republican from upstate New York. It turns out he was from the district that my family, my in-laws in the Adirondacks that we would go to every year. He understood that this shouldn't be about politics. What this is about is undermining our ability to get objective scientific advice from the from experts in the scientific community, and what a threat that posed, regardless of your politics. It shouldn't matter whether you're Republican or Democrat. And so there was that good faith that existed on both sides of the aisle at that time. What's so unfortunate is that we've really lost that good faith. Those sorts of Republicans, they're hard to find these days, and to me that's one of the most disappointing developments here is the way this has become such an explicit partisan issue, whether or not you accept scientific expertise or not.
Well, and as you just mentioned, this does have a long history, this anti-science movement, and you talk about that in the book to some extent, even going back to Galileo and Copernicus. Yeah. But I'm just wondering your take on why now? Why do you think that these anti-science movements take hold at certain points in history? Because we haven't always had this. We had a long tradition, as you did mention in the book. Even the Republican Party was very much the party of science, thinking back towards the second half of the 20th century. So what is it about this moment that you think makes such fertile ground for these anti-science forces to take root?
Yeah, and you're so right. And it isn't just science. Traditionally, the Republicans were supportive of basic funding for science and technology. They were also supportive of environmental action. We forget that Richard Nixon basically created the EPA. Ronald Reagan signed the Montreal Protocol to ban chlorofluorocarbons, these chemicals that were destroying the ozone layer. George H.W. Bush signed legislation to deal with the acid rain problem. In fact, it was George H.W. Bush's administration that was the brainchild of cap and trade. If you've heard that term in a climate context, they developed this system of tradable emissions permits to deal with the acid rain problem. And so for so long, there wasn't this partisan divide, but what happened in the second term of George W. Bush, when sort of Dick Cheney and the energy industry took over their environmental policy. And I would point out that at the beginning of his first term, George W. Bush supported climate action. He actually nominated Christine Todd Whitman, one of those old school pro-science, pro-environment moderates, former governor from New Jersey. And she supported recognizing carbon dioxide as a pollutant that should be regulated under the Clean Air Act. And that's when Dick Cheney and his energy industry friends sort of swooped in. They took over environmental policy. They did everything they could to oust Christine Todd Whitman and hijack sort of energy and environmental policy in that administration. And they never looked back. That was really the critical juncture at which, in my view, that partisan divide developed. And it developed to the point where it became an assault on essentially any science that threatens powerful special interests to which the Republican Party is beholden. And so that is sort of the origin of how they came down on the wrong side of the COVID-19, vaccine science as well.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Mann, how has a disinformation campaign against climate change, as you talked about sort of the seminal moment with Vice President Cheney trying to, oust Christine Todd Whitman. How has it changed over time? What is new today about the disinformation campaign against climate that we should be paying attention to?
Yeah, it's such a good question. And here's the thing that's sort of eerie to us, because Peter and I began writing this book, you know, a year and a half ago. We had no idea what sort of environment it would find itself in when it came out. There's no way we could have imagined the degree to which anti-science has escalated now all the way to the highest levels of our government, where, you know, across all the agencies, career scientists are being replaced with, political operatives, major government sort of departments and administrations are being, you know, dissolved. The National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, Environmental Protection Agency, basically being all but dissolved. The Department of Energy sort of adopting the viewpoint of climate change denialism at the highest levels of their policymaking. Christopher Wright, the DOE secretary, is a former fossil fuel industry CEO who's come in now. He is promoting, you know, misinformation about renewable energy. This whole idea of whales, you know, wind killing whales, that's a myth that they've perpetrated to try to sort of essentially to malign clean energy, because they understand it's a threat to the vested interest, the fossil fuel industry that they're so closely tied to. And we're seeing the Trump administration and a Republican Congress that's basically now a rubber stamp on what the administration is doing, defunding climate science. We've seen, you know, the appointment of Robert F. Kennedy Jr., perhaps the most prominent anti-vaxxer in the world, appointed to head up the, Health and Human Services, HHS, and using that, weaponizing that now to make it increasingly difficult for people to get hold of vaccines at a time when COVID-19 is actually making a comeback and measles is starting to make a comeback because of the anti-vax policies of this administration. And so it's sort of equal opportunity anti-science across all of the departments and agencies, the executive branch, and again, a Congress, a Republican Congress that's a rubber stamp, and even a Supreme Court now, which seems to be a rubber stamp for what they're doing, a lopsided Supreme Court. Science truly is under siege in a way, frankly, that Peter and I could not possibly have imagined a year and a half ago when we began writing this book.
Well, you're listening to Your Calls, One Planet series. I'm Ethan Elkind, and we're speaking with Dr. Michael Mann, Presidential Distinguished Professor in the Department of Earth and Environmental Science at the University of Pennsylvania. We're talking about his new book that he co-authored called Science Under Siege, How to Fight the Five Most Powerful Forces That Threaten Our World. We're going to have a lot more with Dr. Michael Mann coming up just after this short break, so stay with us. Welcome back. For those of you joining us just now, I'm Ethan Elkind, and this is Your Calls One Planet series. We're podcasting our show, and you can find out more information on our website. Go on to kalw.org, click on news, and you can find our program there, Your Call. You can also listen to past shows on our website, sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up next. And if you have a show idea for us, drop us a line at yourcall@kalw.org or call us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Well, we're joined for this hour by Michael Mann, Presidential Distinguished Professor in the Department of Earth and Environmental Science at the University of Pennsylvania. He has a secondary appointment in the Annenberg School for Communication. He's the author of several important books, including The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back Our Planet, Our Fragile Moment, How Lessons from Earth's Past Can Help Us Survive the Climate Crisis. And he's a co-author of the brand new book that we're talking about today called Science Under Siege, How to Fight the Five Most Powerful Forces That Threaten Our World, which he co-authored with Dr. Peter Hotez, who talks about the same attacks on public health researchers and scientists and scholars that climate scientists have been dealing with for decades now. Well, Dr. Mann, let's talk about the five interconnected forces that you've identified behind this assault on science, and you call them the five P's: the plutocrats, the petrostates, the pros, who are paid promoters of anti-science type of disinformation, and the propagandists, and with some important exceptions, the media as well. So can you just give us a little more detail on these forces, how they work together? Maybe we could just start with plutocrats.
Yeah, absolutely. Technically, there are seven P's. I'll get to that in a moment, because one of those groups can actually be expanded. But we do categorize into five, and the first of them, the plutocrats. These are, you know, individuals of great wealth, like the Koch brothers, like Rupert Murdoch, who owns, you know, a massive global media empire. Elon Musk, who, you know, bought Twitter and ended up weaponizing it as a massive purveyor of anti-science misinformation and disinformation about climate and COVID-19, and a whole bunch of other things. And so these are individuals, great wealth, who, for whatever reason, be it a fossil fuel interest or, you know, a libertarian or conservative viewpoints, have decided to use their immense wealth and influence to fund social, you know, media platforms or news networks or front groups, think tanks, AstroTurf organizations, to create what my good friend Naomi Oreskes, a science historian from Harvard University, has described as a Potemkin village, this sort of facade that looks authoritative because there are all these different groups with these, you know, very official sounding names and individuals that they, you know, fund to be spokespeople who have, you know, impressive credentials. They've created this sort of facade that promotes anti-science. And the plutocrats are the main funders of that.
And you also make an interesting point about the connection between cryptocurrency and some of these petrostates, particularly Russia, and how it's involved in this well-funded campaign against scientists. And that's this focus on cryptocurrency. These tech bros who are proselytizing cryptocurrency often have anti-science viewpoints. And of course, cryptocurrency is the way that Russia is able to evade sanctions. Yeah. And now Donald Trump is making a lot of money. Personally, his family's making a lot of money on cryptocurrency. Can you talk about that connection?
Yeah, absolutely. So that the next category, the petrostates, and, you know, these are typically authoritarian nations, Saudi Arabia, Russia being, you know, perhaps the two most prominent, that derive their, you know, their economic growth primarily from the extraction of natural resources, and in particular fossil fuels, hence petrostate. And there are, you know, it's, you know, petrostates that sort of the entity at the national level. But within petrostates, you also have polluters. They can be state fossil fuel companies, like in Russia, there's Rosneft, for example. But there are polluters who are sort of who are supported by the nation, fossil fuel interests, and you have the politicians who enable their agenda. And so the politicians and the polluters, those are two more P's, and they're very closely linked to the plutocrats. The petrostates. So we sort of put that category into one thing: the petrostates and the polluters and the politicians who work with them closely. But there are also linkages back with the plutocrats, you know, the first category we talked about, because you have individuals like Elon Musk who have weaponized Twitter so that countries like Russia and Saudi Arabia can massively spread their misinformation and disinformation. And in fact, both Russia and Saudi Arabia helped Elon Musk buy Twitter. And they did that because they recognized what an opportunity that would be for them to massively spread misinformation that supports their agenda. And as you say, cryptocurrency is one way that some of these petrostates can evade sanctions against them. And so if you understand that Elon Musk is really working pretty close here with state actors, petrostates like Saudi Arabia and Russia, then you understand why Elon Musk is such a big fan of cryptocurrency and why there all these tech bros have sort of become big fans of cryptocurrency, because it is literally the currency with which these rogue state actors are able to evade sanctions against them. And finally, you know, as we point out in the book, and this was a late development because we finalized the book, after the election. It was mostly written before the election, but we can, you know, we're forced now to classify the United States as a petrostate because its government, the executive branch, Republican Congress, and even the Supreme Court seem to be working together now to advance the interests of this very large fossil fuel industry within the United States and the policies that we are seeing, the environmental policies that are literally being eradicated, decades of environmental protections of clean water, clean air, and of course, climate action itself, all of that being dissembled in a matter of months. The United States has to be viewed now as a petrostate itself, at least under this current administration and in this current sort of political milieu that we find ourselves in.
Well, of course, the context that the U.S. is now exporting more fossil fuel than we're actually using, which is a big change in our history. So I wanted to just go to a listener. We have an email question in from Arnie in Berkeley, who writes, how do you feel about debating people who peddle misinformation? Is it better to take them on or ignore them? Can you hear me? Do we lose you, Dr. Mann?
Hello?
Yeah. Are you there?
Yeah.
All right. Sorry. Were we able to hear that question? We had
no, I didn't hear anything.
Okay. Sorry. It was an email question from Arnie in Berkeley, who writes, how do you feel about debating people who peddle misinformation? Is it better to take them on or ignore them? I think we're losing
you. Yeah, I'm back. Not sure what happened there.
All right. Well, were you able to just hear the question there from Arnie?
No. Can you repeat it? I'm sorry. Sure. About that.
All right. No problem. The question was, how do you feel about debating people who peddle misinformation? Is it better to take them on or ignore them?
Thanks. Great question. There's actually a subsection in one of the chapters, Debate Me, Bro. and that's actually a line that was sort of used against my co-author, Peter Hotez, when he found himself under this very coordinated this campaign to try to force him to debate RFK Jr., an anti-vaxxer, on the Joe Rogan podcast. And Elon Musk sort of weighed in and used all of his influence and power and others sort of who are part of that anti-science community. There was this pile on, and it was all intended to try to force Peter to debate RFK Jr. Now, in the book, we, you know, talk quite a bit about why that is often not a good idea. I have a colleague who puts it this way. I think it's pretty succinct. It's like, if I debate you, it's going to look really good on your resume, and it's going to look really bad on my resume. And that's sort of really a shorthand for saying you're elevating sort of a proponent of anti-science to the same level as, you know, the same level as science and scientists, and that conveys to the public that these are two equally valid positions. One, you know, that vaccines are, you know, a conspiracy by Bill Gates to install chips in people to control them. You're putting that, you know, that sort of bizarre conspiracy-laden mythology on the same footing as like the consensus of the world's leading public health scientists. And that conveys to the public, you know, that there is genuine uncertainty. You know, you get up on the stage with somebody who's promoting anti-science, you're sort of saying to the audience, at least you're starting out from the standpoint that these are two equally valid viewpoints. And as the scientist, you have to spend the debate trying to work back to where the actual weight of the evidence is, which is on your side, 99.999 whatever to 0.00 whatever. There's a great example of this. My good friend Bill Nye, in a segment on the Comedy Channel, I forget which, I think it was John Oliver's program some years ago, where like they take some, you know, random person off the street, you know, he's a climate change denier. And then they say, well, we'll invite Bill Nye, the science guy, to come debate you. And Bill Nye comes out onto the stage. And he's joined by 99 lab coat wearing scientists to join him to sort of convey that overwhelmingly the weight of evidence is on one side. And if you just make it a debate between two people, it sends the wrong opinion. That having been the wrong message, that having been said, it is important for us to not allow misinformation and disinformation to fester, to push back at it. And there are contexts in which it does make sense to do this. And again, I'll go back to Bill. Bill has, you know, at various times engaged in prominent debates with evolution deniers and with climate deniers. And he's well situated to do that because he's not really representing the scientific community. So it's not like, you know, a leading scientist getting up on the stage. It's instead, it's this person we all grew up learning science from. And most of us, you know, really, you know, there's sort of an attachment, an affection for Bill. He's the right person to get up on the stage with, you know, a charlatan. But probably in most contexts, the leading scientists themselves aren't. And it's really important for the public to understand that, you know, scientific understanding doesn't come about through debates between talking heads on a stage. It comes about through the peer-reviewed literature, scientists doing the research, publishing it, getting feedback, presenting it at meetings, getting feedback at those meetings. This is the self-correcting machinery of science that Carl Sagan so eloquently talked about, that moves us ever towards a better and better understanding of the world, even if any one study, any one scientist might be wrong. That process, the process of peer review and the establishment of scientific consensus is what leads us forward. And it should never be presented as if that, you know, very robust basis of our understanding of policy relevant science, that should never be put on an equal footing with, you know, some crackpot who has a website that's promoting garbage and misinforming people, especially when that misinformation, as is the case here with both climate and COVID-19, that misinformation and disinformation is literally deadly. It's killing people.
So you're listening to Your Calls One Planet series. I'm Ethan Elkind, and we're talking to Dr. Michael Mann, Presidential Distinguished Professor in the Department of Earth and Environmental Science at the University of Pennsylvania, and co-author of the brand new book, Science Under Siege, How to Fight the Five Most Powerful Forces That Threaten Our World. We do have an email in from Dave, who says, allow me to recommend the Bay Area Science Calendar that lists enjoyable science events and presentations for everyone, scientists and not, and subscribe to the weekly SciSchmooze newsletter written for the Bay Area. Both are available at bayareascience.org. Dave, thank you for that. And we have another David, a caller, David from Morro Bay, dialing in. David, welcome to Your Calls One Planet series.
Hi there. How are you doing?
Good. Welcome. What's your question for Dr. Mann?
Well, thank you. My question is, how many scientists does Elon Musk have on his payroll?
Yeah.
In other words, they use science all the time. So unless you define science, how can science be under attack? It's not science that's under attack. It's the way in which science is being delivered to the public.
Thank you, David, for that. Yeah, Dr. Mann, response.
Yeah, thanks to both Davids. The first point is great. You know, we have to make learning about science fun, exciting. And there are all of these programs that exist that are out there. And Bay Area just has a sort of an embarrassment of riches when it comes to the academic institutions, the scientific institutions, and all of the lecture series and talk series and groups. And so absolutely, let's make learning science and talking about science and communicating science exciting and fun and fashionable. To the second Dave, that's a great point. I mean, it's what's ironic to me is that Elon Musk traditionally was a great proponent of science. And you know, if you go back, I don't know, 8 years or so, there's actually an exchange between him and me. There were a couple exchanges on Twitter at that time where we were sort of both ridiculing climate denialism. And so that's where he was. And obviously Tesla, you know, the company Tesla that sort of really revolutionized the electric vehicle industry, played such an important role in sort of the clean energy transition. Solar City, another Musk-owned company, you know, making a massive solar energy, you know, not just, you know, available, but available at a reasonable expense. So it's really sad to those of us who knew Elon early on, because he was a hero of ours. And to me, it's sort of like a tragic Bond film. There's like a Bond villain like arc where like the hero, something happens along the way, who knows, his ego's hurt by somebody and he becomes this villain. And that's sort of the arc that Elon has, you know, traveled along, because now he really does use his platform, Twitter, to promote anti-science. Now, it's not just about the policies, to promote bad science when it comes to clean energy, when it comes to climate, and certainly when it comes to COVID-19 and vaccines. And so, you know, it's unfortunate, it's sad, it's tragic, because he was a hero. He could still be a hero if he sort of returns to doing what he once did. Not only, you know, putting his, you know, money where his mouth is and funding important pieces of the clean energy transition and important pieces of sort of the public-private scientific infrastructure, but communicating it so effectively as he once did.
Yeah. Well, thank you, David, for that call. We have another caller, Bob in Santa Rosa, dialing in. Bob, welcome to Your Calls One Planet series.
Thank you. And thank you for your book, sir.
Thank you.
My question is pretty simple. Given what seems to be the plethora of evidence and scientific information in support of reality, what do you think is a possible way to do this in schools? Because it seems to me that's where the disinformation has to be, you know, combated the most, because everybody's on their screens and everybody's taking all of their quote facts in from anonymous internet sources. Do you have any idea how to respond or deal with that?
Yes, thanks so much. That was Bob?
Yes.
Thanks, Bob. It's such a great question, and it may seem gratuitous of me, but in answering it, I have to give a shout out for a Bay Area-based organization called the National Center for Science Education. It's based in Oakland, California, and I was once on their board and the board of advisors. And they started out as an organization that would help sort of K through 12 teachers with the teaching of evolution in school when it was under attack for ideological and political reasons. And over the years, they realized that the same thing was going on with climate. The teaching of basic climate science in, again, primary, secondary education was under assault, a coordinated assault. And so their mission is to help teachers, especially in communities where there is sort of a coordinated effort to introduce anti-scientific teaching into the schools and to squelch teaching of, you know, topics like evolution and climate science. They really help schools across the country. They arm them with the support and the sort of the background information that teachers really need so that they can make sure that their students are, you know, are getting the best information that's available, are getting the actual science here. And it's so critical. You know, I think you're absolutely right, because this, it's young folks, it's our children and grandchildren who are most going to inherit the legacy of the decisions we're making now. They are going to be most impacted by the, you know, the climate crisis if we fail to act. And yet they don't really have a voice yet. They don't have a vote. And they don't have a voice that, you know, many of us have, you know, and so we can't wait for them to grow up and be in a position of influence and be in a position to really leverage their own voice and to be in a position to vote for politicians who will do what's right for them rather than who are beholden to these bad actors. We can't wait. We don't have 15 years. We don't have 20 years. And so we need to make sure that we do what's necessary now so that they don't inherit a degraded planet. At the same time,
yeah,
you're absolutely right. We have to make sure they are as informed as possible. And, you know, we have to make sure that we do everything we can to defend basic science education in our schools.
Well, and so many of these young people are getting their information from social media. They're being influenced by far right YouTubers, propaganda. What could be done about that?
Yeah, another great question. And Peter and I talk about that. We really believe there needs to be a better regulation of social media companies right now. They basically got carte blanche. They're not subject to the same sorts of regulation that traditional media are subject to. They've managed to evade that. They've managed to evade that in part because a lot of these big tech companies, these social media companies, use their immense wealth and power to lobby politicians against passing common sense regulations of, especially when we're talking about dangerous misinformation that can lead, we've heard, examples in the news of people who commit suicide, young kids, subject to online campaigns of hate who end up taking their own lives. There's some responsibility there. And of course, to get those sorts of laws in place, we need politicians who will support us, will support our interests rather than these special interests. And it does come down to us. It comes down to us voting in massive numbers so that we win back our politics and we can, we get the politicians that we deserve and that we can affect the sorts of policies that are necessary to penalize bad faith, misinformation, and disinformation, and provide more truth and clarity and common sense regulation of our social media platforms.
Yeah. Well, we're almost out of time, Dr. Mann. I just wanted to end on a question about what you really would like to see done. I mean, we just talked here just now about regulating social media. I mean, what sort of advice would you have for people to get involved to try to counter this anti-science dynamic that is really taking hold in our society right now?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll just build on, my last answer. It's taking back our politics, using our vote and our voice. Our vote, because we need politicians who will defend basic science-based policymaking and fact-based discourse, fact-based decision-making. So that falls upon us to turn out and vote in every single election to try to win back our politics so that we can get the sorts of progress that we need at the legislative level, at the executive level, and with our courts, who are, in the end, arbiters of much of many of the decisions that are being made by the current administration. But that's, and our voice, talk about it, make sure everybody around you knows how much you care about the future and how much we need to do to defend it, to protect it.
Such an important message. And on the climate science, we did get a message from someone who called off air saying it's too late. We're headed toward disaster and can't go back. What do you say to this kind of gloom and doom messaging, just briefly on the climate science?
Yeah, it's very damaging. And there are a lot of good people who fall victim to it. And there are bad actors who are weaponizing. They're fanning the flames of doomism because they realize it leads to inaction, and in the end, business as usual, which is what they want. And so let's recognize that there is great urgency, but there is agency too. The science tells us it is not too late to act.
Yes, well, still hope for us, and many thanks to you for bringing that hope, information, and facts to this public debate. Michael Mann, Presidential Distinguished Professor in the Department of Earth and Environmental Science at the University of Pennsylvania and co-author of the new book, Science Under Siege, How to Fight the Five Most Powerful Forces That Threaten Our World. Thank you so much for joining us here on Your Calls One Planet series.
Oh, thank you. It was a pleasure. Would love to come back again sometime.
Absolutely. We'd love to have you back on, and thank you again for your work to bring science into this public debate. Greatly appreciate it. Well, for the next couple of days, we're going to be talking about the assassination of Charlie Kirk here on Your Call. So stay tuned. Same time, same station. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit us on our website via kalw.org. You can also find us and follow us on social media and email your show ideas and feedback to yourcall@kalw.org. Balihe Razazan produced today's show. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Ethan Elkind. It's Your Call.